Welcome to the Animal Voices Show here on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, BC, Canada. Today is Friday, August 23rd, 2013. I'm one of your hosts, Cynthia Ganatra, and I'm joined here today by my co-host, Jackie McIntosh.
Hey.
And Allison Cole.
Hello.
Alyssa, Tim, and Jenny are away today. Welcome, everyone. Today's show is called Tuttle and Turtles. Animal Voices is Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living, broadcasting live every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and bringing you interviews, commentary, news, and events that you need to keep yourselves updated on what's happening both locally and abroad. We encourage the movement toward a world where non-human animals are treated with compassion and mercy and afforded the basic right to live free from exploitation. In addition to our live broadcast here on 100.5 FM and at cooperadio.org, our shows are also available at as podcasts on iTunes and at animalvoices.org after airing. I'm really excited about today's show. To start the show, Allison will do a book review of Gorilla Food, Living and Eating Organic, Vegan and Raw, by Vancouver's own vegan restaurant owner, Aaron Ash. We'll also be discussing how to have a successful vegan wedding with meat eaters. One of our lovely co-hosts was recently married. Find out who by listening in. We'll also be drawing for Betty Goes Vegan Cookbook. Our first interview, we have Elizabeth Hogan from the World Society of the Protection of Animals, or WSPA, speaking about the Stop Sea Turtle Farm campaign. The campaign is to stop the Cayman Turtle Farm, which breeds and sells these beautiful endangered species in a factory farm type environment for meat. And our feature interview, we are delighted and honored to have back Dr. Will Tuttle, award-winning speaker, author, educator, musician, and Zen Buddhist master. His music, writing, and presentations focus on creativity, intuition, and compassion. Dr. Tuttle will be discussing his main ideas from his best-selling book, The World Peace Diet, which has been called one of the most important books of the 21st century. It's definitely one of the most important books I've ever read, and we are excited to discuss topics that weren't covered the last time he was here. And Dr. Tuttle will also be speaking in Vancouver this week. So listen in to find out when and where.
For the last month or so, as you both know, I've been testing recipes from this year's new book title that's called by local restaurateur Aaron Ash, called Gorilla Food, Living and Eating Organic, Vegan, and Raw. And for those in the know of the vegan and raw food scene in Vancouver, you'll of course recognize this book is coming from the raw food cafe of the same name, Gorilla Food, located here in downtown Vancouver. It's been running since 2006, and since then has seemed to have really escalated in popularity among both locals and tourists, even attracting the business of celebrities such as Keanu Reeves and Katie Holmes. I love the raw food diet, and I've been embracing it much lately, making almost 100% of my food at home uncooked. And with having finally acquired a wonderful Excalibur dehydrator recently, which this book makes ample use of, I was excited to tackle these recipes, which range from smoothies to appetizers to salads and soups to desserts. This book is published by the local Arsenal Pulp Press, and first of all, I would like to give compliments to the colorful and attractive layout of the 247-page soft cover volume that the book presents. It is apparently Arsenal Pulp Press's bestseller these days, having just come out this spring, and I can see why. The pages are very alluring as you flip through them and gaze over such incredibly creative and healthful-looking recipes with photographs such as strawberry goji chia and flaxseed bread, dreamy cream, avocado, carrot and basil soup, and Bliss Butterflies desserts. I also really enjoy reading Aaron's personal little stories that are weaved throughout the pages, as he often provides a short narration to explain how a certain recipe became or how it is favored at the restaurant, for example. That personal touch in the book certainly attracts the reader to keep going through the pages, as you want to read the story that is described via a myriad of recipes, all made with whole plant-based ingredients and all under the temperature of 118 degrees. So this book, Gorilla Food, makes use of a large variety of both fresh and dried fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, oils such as coconut and olive oil, spices, and what are known as superfoods such as acai and maca powders, for example. I feel that you're getting the full-on raw experience by diving into making an assortment of these recipes, as I have done, and you are going to need the special equipment to make many of these recipes, a high-speed blender and a dehydrator. So what did I make and how did the recipes turn out? First of all, going into the book, I was already told to be aware that unfortunately at least several of the recipes in this book don't work out properly. And why is that, you might ask? Because apparently they were not tested prior to having the book published. And that's really quite unfortunate. Erin uses all weight measurements in the restaurant. And for reader-friendly purposes, the measurements all had to be converted into cups and tablespoons and teaspoons. And that is why you'll see many awkward-looking measurements calling for 5/8 of a cup of this and 3/8 of a cup of that. This is quite an unusual format when it comes to recipe books, I shall say. And not to mention as well that many of the recipes require assembling together other recipes from other pages throughout the book, which also makes for some awkward flipping back and forth and hopefully not missing on acquiring any needed ingredients when you are planning what to make. So apart from that, let's talk about the food, because I brought you both quite a bit of food over the last month. Cynthia, you particularly like the Circa Loco Tops, as they are called. Creative names of these recipes, by the way, because they're just invented by Erin Ash, the author. Now, this was an appetizer made with a dehydrated curry squash bread, a coconut lemon butter on top, which didn't really turn into butter, but it still tasted good, and an apple chutney on top of that.
It was delicious. It I was. Loved like the combination of flavors, and even though the coconut butter didn't turn into butter, mm-hmm. I kind of liked that it was crumbly and it added a little bit more texture, so it was just delicious.
It worked out
so yum.
I think a lot of these recipes have been results of just experiments in the kitchen, so yeah, so it's kind of like maybe not so bad of a thing that not all of these recipes work like they're supposed to. For example, I made the blueberry mango fruit pie for a potluck that I was at, and it was a really, really beautiful kind of like creamy Swiss sweet cheesecake type texture, supposed to set in the fridge, did not set in the fridge. I had to put it into the freezer, and by the time it got to Surrey and was ready to be eaten, it was totally sunken in. But everyone was just oohing and aahing about it and said it was really, really tasty. So how are the samosas that I brought today?
Yeah. So as most of you don't know, because you're on video on radio, I'm Indian, and so not like I'm an expert in Indian food, but it was actually
samosas.
Yeah, it was delicious. It didn't look like samosa. It reminded me more of a pakora, but really yum, and just nice to know you can make something in a really healthy way and for it to taste good. Yeah. And that's what I love about his recipes. Even if they don't work out well, they're whole, organic, plant-based ingredients.
Yeah, you can't really go wrong with the ingredients. And I was told by one of my taste testers that the samosas taste marijuana-y. So there you go. take that as you wish. They are pretty good. So the bottom line basically is this is a beautiful book to read, but beware of awkwardly laid out recipes that don't always work out as indicated. That's the Gorilla Food Book.
All right, and I have some headlines for you. So, foie gras maker drops humane label after false advertising lawsuit. I'm not sure how they were even able to put that on their label to begin with, but the largest producer of foie gras in the U.S., Hudson Valley Foie Gras, has agreed to remove the word humane from its advertising and website. The decision is the result of a lawsuit filed by the Animal Legal Defense Fund and Elna Nemkova, founder of The Regal Vegan. The ALDF argues that foie gras can never be humane or cruelty-free because of the very nature of the product requires ducks to be force-fed. The ducks may grow livers as much as 8 times the healthy size and can develop painful liver condition called hepatic lipidosis, which is associated with diarrhea, seizures, and death.
Horrible.
Yeah, it's interesting that they could even call that humane, but I also found it's somewhat interesting how at the very end of the article it says, Wells also said the false advertising on foie gras unfairly encourages consumers to choose Hudson Valley's product instead of the truly cruelty-free vegan products like the Regal Vegan's faux, F-A-U-X, gras, which is apparently made by walnut butter or something like that. So, yeah,
vegan butter, I hope.
Vegan butter.
yeah. No, it's 100% vegan. It's interesting that was in the same article, but I guess because she was part of the lawsuit. Another story more close to home. The white bear cub returns to BC town after relocation last year. So a rare white-colored bear cub that has wandered back to a small town in southeastern BC to feast on the community's garbage will not be euthanized, say conservation officers. So they are looking at alternate solutions, perhaps a placement in a sanctuary or a relocation again. But looking into this further, it also says that relocations of particularly black bears, and this, even though this bear is white, it is actually related to the black bear. It's not the same as a Kermode or spirit bear. They said typically black bears are euthanized when they are found to be very bold around humans, which is unfortunate. But for whatever reason, I'm guessing particularly because it is a cute white bear.
That's what I was thinking. There's human logic for you. Yeah. You save it because it's cute.
Yeah, exactly. I think all bears are cute. And
colorism.
Honestly, my thoughts on this article, all bears are cute and beautiful, and people need to be more careful with their garbage.
Drishti Point is a radio program featuring interviews about yoga, spirituality, and wellness. Our guests include yogis, authors, musicians, healers, and renowned spiritual teachers. Tune in Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. for your weekly dose of yoga wisdom and inspiration.
So this last weekend was a wedding for one of our co-hosts. And which co-host was that? It was Jackie.
Yeah, it was me.
She married her lovely wife, Ashley, in a beautiful ceremony in Pemberton. And I was lucky enough to be there. Actually, just thinking about it, I'm almost tearing up again. It was honestly one of the most beautiful weddings. Aww. All vegan. My first vegan wedding. It was lovely to be able to eat everything, and the food was amazing. So congratulations from me and everybody else. And yeah, so please tell us how, because I know I'm a vegan and I was there, and I know there was a few others, but we were definitely the minority, not the majority. Mm-hmm. And so tell us a bit about how to have meat eaters at a vegan wedding.
Yeah, well, for us, I mean, we honestly, we even had trouble with the word wedding. We preferred to call it like a love celebration because, I don't know, there's a sense of ego and things like that with the term wedding. So we just, but on the same note, we still wanted to, you know, stay true to our beliefs, and just on every step of the way, we tried to keep it as waste-free as possible. I think at the end of it, we only had like a small shopping plastic bag full of garbage for like the very end of the weekend. Wow. Everything else was composted or recycled, so that was amazing. So yeah, we just made everything vegan, and it was mostly, you know, omnivores or people that even called themselves carnivores and were so worried about the vegan side of things that they actually were saying they were going to try to sneak meat in and things like that. But you know what? In the end, they didn't, and they were very happy with the food. They especially loved the coconut bacon, and I wasn't even sure if I was going to include that, so I'm glad I did.
Love the coconut bacon. Yeah. I even had it in the morning on my vegan macaroni and cheese for breakfast. It was delightful.
Yeah, and that's another thing I would recommend too. If you're, you know, cooking for omnivore, carnivore type people, just try to make it really foods that they recognize, like vegan mac and cheese or lasagna or chili or things like that. Or even we made like a jackfruit kind of, I don't like to use the term, but it kind of looked like pulled pork, but it's just jackfruit and sauce, and it people just appreciate that when it's something so unfamiliar to them, rather than, you know.
And you gave them lots of options.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, there was a lot of food left over. I can say that for sure. But it was fun. It was nice to cook for everybody and just make everyone have a wonderful time where they didn't feel like they were missing out.
Yeah, and it was also the Pemberton Slow Food Festival, which we attended as well. So
yeah, it was great.
The day after, we got on our bikes and we went to the different farms, and it was lovely. We got some amazing potatoes. Unfortunately, the potatoes they were sampling all had butter on them, but we were able to buy potatoes sans the butter. And there was also, the farm had some animals on it, and you spent some time with them.
It was kind of interesting. They had on the potato farm, I'm not sure if it was related with the potato farm or just other people bringing, you know, their chickens and things. And they were set up in kind of, you know, what people think is an idyllic view of free range organic animals. They were in these like little, you know, chicken houses with grass and everything. But people, I guess, still need to realize, you know, even though it looks so idyllic, these animals are still, you know, going to end up the same way. And also, there's so many unnecessary things that these animals go through, like the male, for laying chickens, the males are still slaughtered at birth. These animals live a very, very short fraction of their lives. And the worst part is it's so unnecessary, like no human requires that to live, requires to eat that to live. That's the saddest part of it.
Definitely. But it was a great festival, and I recommend people to go check it out, because there's lots of great local organic vegetables as well. So check it out next year. You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Our first interview today is with Elizabeth Hogan, who is a campaigns manager for Oceans and Wildlife with the World Society for the Protection of Animals, more commonly known as WSPA. WSPA has been protecting animals around the world for over 30 years. Today, WSPA works in over 50 countries, collaborating with local communities, NGOs, and governments to help change animals' lives for the better. WSPA also acts for animals at a global level, using their United Nations consultative status to give them a voice. Today, we'll be speaking with Elizabeth about their Stop Sea Turtle Farm campaign, where they're trying to stop the suffering and exploitation of sea turtles at the Cayman Turtle Farm. Hello, Elizabeth, and welcome to the Animal Voices Show.
Oh, good. Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. So can you explain to our listeners who may not know what a sea turtle farm is and how many farms there are in the world?
Well, sure. Just like any farm, it's a business where animals are bred, raised, and slaughtered for human consumption. Although in this case, remember that we are talking about a wild animal, not something that has been domesticated over thousands of years, like a cow. And we're also talking about an endangered species. There are a few turtle farms in the world. I believe most of them are in China, but there's only one remaining sea turtle farm in the world, and this is it, the Cayman Turtle Farm.
Okay, so I love turtles. I just don't know too much about them. So what kind of sea turtles are at the Cayman? There's different types of sea turtles, I assume.
Yes, there are seven different species of sea turtles. The vast majority of the turtles at the Cayman Turtle Farm are green sea turtles. The farm also houses a few hawksbill and Kemp's Ridley sea turtles, which, like green sea turtles, they are also endangered species. But the green sea turtles are the only ones that are commercially bred and sold as meat.
Wow. And do you know how many of them are currently living there?
The numbers are constantly in flux right now. Mm-hmm. The estimate is that there are approximately 9,500.
Wow, that is a lot of turtles. Wow, I wasn't expecting that number. So you say on your website, stopseaturtlesfarm.org, that there's no humane way to farm turtles. There's a video on your website that shows the conditions of these sea turtles, and it's quite literally a factory farm type condition for turtles. Can you explain the conditions that these sea turtles are subjected to living in the farm and how their behavior may be different than those from the wild?
The important thing to remember about sea turtles is that they are solitary animals. They only come together to mate, and that's it. Hmm. And when you think about their conditions in the wild, they will swim an average of 2,600 kilometers, which for people listening in the U.S. is 1,600 miles.
Thanks.
grounds and their nesting beaches. And they can dive more than 90 meters or 300 feet. And the conditions at the farm cram these solitary animals into tiny, shallow concrete tanks. They're not even filled all the way up. There's no way they could possibly dive. They're only about 2 feet deep. They certainly can't swim a significant distance or engage in any of their natural behaviors. And the conditions force the turtles to fight each other for food and space. So you see a lot of signs of captivity stress, including cannibalism, mm-hmm. a lot of hyperactivity, frenzied feeding. Most of the turtles will show signs of injury and disease and other abnormalities, some of which you'll find in intensive farming situations.
Yeah, definitely. So what do they feed the turtles compared to their natural diet, which I believe is a herbivorous diet?
It is. Yeah. In the wild, they eat seagrasses. At the farm, they feed them, it looks like pet food. It looks like brown pet kibble. They're these tiny brown processed pellets, and I got a look at one of the feed bags and saw the ingredients, and it says processed grain byproducts and animal and plant protein products. It doesn't get much more specific than that, but it's definitely not seagrass.
Yeah, it sounds very similar to factory farming, where animals are not fed their natural diets.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was watching the video, which is on your website, as I mentioned, stopseaturtlesfarm.org, the YouTube video that shows the conditions of these turtles basically crammed into these tiny ponds, basically. Why are some of them missing eyes? I don't know. That was really alarming to me.
The condition is called anopsalmia, and it's the result of a genetic mutation. you know, possibly the result of the captive conditions, but a turtle with that condition should not be in any type of breeding situation with other turtles and definitely should not be released into the wild.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. How did WISPA learn about the sea turtle farm? And you mentioned that you saw the bag, so have you been there and seen it firsthand?
I have been there. I was there last fall and visited the farm a few times. We learned about it because we received numerous complaints, emails, and phone calls from concerned tourists. The facility is open to the public. It's actually a very large tourist draw on the island, and visitors who had been were alarmed at the conditions and notified us.
Yeah, so it's a tourist attraction, so it's open to visitors, so the visitors can come in and play with the turtles, lift them up, and so yes. What does that do? Our turtles, like you said, are like to be isolated, so I'm sure they don't like to be person handled.
they really don't. For me, it's actually one of the saddest parts of the farm, and I hate watching it. You'll see in all of the farm's advertisements and their promotional material that they're very proud to offer what they call an interactive experience, which means exactly what you described, that visitors can pick up the turtles and pose with them for pictures. They're the juvenile turtles, obviously, because the adults are massively big, hundreds and hundreds of pounds. So the juveniles are about a year old, and people can climb in the tanks with them and pick them up and, you know, take pictures and pose with them. And, it's definitely not good for the turtles. You see them panic as soon as they're pulled out of the water, which happens over and over, and the staff actively encourages this.
It's horrible.
And the panicking causes two main health risks for the turtle. The first one is they'll inhale very quickly as they panic, and they'll get water in their lungs and can then easily develop a lung infection. And then they panic when you pull them out, and they start flapping around frantically, so they can break or dislocate their flippers.
Oh my gosh, that sounds horrible. So how do they, I saw somewhere that they claim to promote conservation at this facility. Is that true, or how can they say that?
I would argue that they can't,
yeah.
But they do make that claim. It's based on two different arguments. The first is that they release some of the captive bred turtles into the wild, which unfortunately is more of a deterrent to conservation than actually helping, because the turtles they're releasing, as we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. they often carry diseases and genetic abnormalities as a result of the captive conditions, and then they'll contaminate the wild population. But because the farm is releasing them, they claim they're helping the wild population. And their second claim is that by providing a legal source of turtle meat, that they are preventing poaching. But that simply doesn't make sense, because the turtle meat that's sold by the farm is the highest priced meat on the islands, and a poached turtle is always free. So, of course, poaching will continue.
Wow. So you have this Stop Sea Turtle Farm campaign. Can you tell us a little bit about the campaign and what progress have you guys made to stop this farming?
Sure. The campaign has been something of a whirlwind. We started almost 2 years ago with initially conducting our own investigation after we'd heard from people that were so concerned and were initially alerted to the problems there. We tried very hard after we compiled our own evidence to negotiate with the farm for several months to talk about changing the conditions there. And our end goal is to convert the farm into a rehabilitation center, which could still be open to the public and enjoy that revenue and hopefully be self-sustaining. But I can honestly say we took every step imaginable before going public with the information, but the farm did not want to work with us from day one, so here we are. There have been so many different elements to the campaign because of the different implications. There's the conservation of this endangered species to consider, as well as human health and the welfare of these incredible animals, not to mention the economic burden to the Caymanian people.
And what do you mean by human health? What's the threat to humans?
Well, sea turtles are natural carriers of several pathogens, including E. coli and Salmonella.
Mm.
And so that's in the wild, and when you put them in intensive captive conditions crowded into tanks, then the pathogens multiply a lot faster than they would in normal conditions. So you put these turtles in these crowded tanks and then encourage humans to get in the tanks and pick up the turtles, then, of course, you're risking the transfer of those pathogens, especially young children who are so excited to, grab these turtles, but their immune systems are not fully developed. And then if they rub their eye or put their hand in their mouth, that's not a very good situation.
It does not sound like a good situation at all. And what did you also mean by threaten the local economy?
Well, the turtle farm operates at a significant loss year over year. They generate only about one-third of the income that they need to operate, and that loss has been subsidized by the Caymanian government, which on average is $9 million Caymanian dollars per year, which is over 11 million Canadian,
wow,
and almost 11 million U.S. So I'm thinking that the taxpaying residents of the Cayman Islands could think of lots of other uses for that money.
Yeah, hopefully they will work to stop it. How can the public, like somebody like us, support your Sea Turtle Stop Sea Turtle Farm campaign?
Well, there's lots of things that people could do to help. We have public actions from time to time, and petitions to sign, letters to the Cayman Turtle Farm or to the Caymanian government. I would say first and foremost, though, the best thing you can do is be a responsible tourist, especially as a cruise ship passenger where tickets to this attraction are sold all the time. If you see any type of activity where a wild animal is being mistreated, and even if someone at the facility is telling you, oh, it's fine, go ahead and pick up the turtle, if your instinct kicks in and you think this doesn't look good for the turtle, definitely speak up and say something. In a survey that we did last year, 90% of tourists said they would not participate in an activity if they learned animals were being mistreated. And many people were willing to pay extra money for a ticket if it means better conditions for the animals. So people feel strongly about this, and they can always speak up. And if people want to be actively involved in our campaign, then, you know, please go to the website and sign up for our newsletter, join us on Facebook and Twitter, and that way you can be informed of when we need your assistance for public actions. And if you want to sign a petition or participate in anything else that we're doing, then we would love to have your support.
So you say that 90% of tourists say that they wouldn't want to be a part of anything hurting animals, is that correct? But yet they're willing to pay tickets for these exhibits that they see. And my feeling about this, because I visited islands like this, and actually this actually reminds me of when I was in Bermuda just recently, there was a so-called rescued sea turtle project, which was basically a very shallow concrete pond on the side of the road where there were these beautiful, huge turtles just living in this little pond. And I was trying to figure out how it was that this was a rescue project where it looks like they're imprisoned. But that's sort of going off on an aside here. What I want to get into more is people don't want to support cruel activities and cruel ventures that these islands want to sort of promote to tourists. But I kind of feel like when you're a tourist, like people are unaware, they don't realize what is behind this. I guess that's what how the campaign is effective, because you're campaigning here in North America, right? And it's just, I feel like it's just a matter of getting the word and getting people educated so that they, when they go to these places and when they get off the cruise ships and they realize like this is something that's offered, exchange your money to see the sea turtles and touch them in that they will be armed with the knowledge to know that, like, no, I'm not going to do that. I already know about that. Is that where you see this campaign sort of leading in that direction?
Oh, definitely. Public education is a huge component to it. And one, you know, we've certainly tried to reach out to people that do like to go on cruises, in particular, because cruise traffic is such a huge part of the group of tourists that go to visit the farm. And absolutely, research before your trip is essential. Look into what the activities are that are going to be available to you. And if any of them involve wild animals, just think in terms of, you know, whether the animal involved is actually engaging in their natural behavior or,
exactly,
or if they're not, is a good litmus test for any activity. And find an alternative, snorkeling and diving, going on whale watches, you know, seeing them in their natural habitats,
I've snorkeled with turtles, and we were told,
don't
touch
great.
Them.
Exactly.
And it was just
totally.
Us subsisting among each other, not touching, taking pictures. Yeah. It was awesome.
Yeah. And that's the best way to interact with them in the wild, because that's their behavior, and that's the most beautiful way
and
to see them.
They'll come to you if they want to.
And they usually do.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth, for being on our show today. It was great speaking with you and giving us our listeners that advice, which I think is super important to know before you go on any kind of trips, that even if people are telling you that these animals are happy, really looking into if they actually are, especially when people have business in mind. So thank you once again, and thank you to WISPA and the Stop Sea Turtle Farm Campaign. I went online and signed the petition, and so can you. To sign the petition and find out more about the campaign, please visit stopseaturtlefarm.org. And there's also a link on our Animal Voices website at animalvoices.org.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you again. Thanks.
Thank you. So you are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada. And exciting enough, we have a draw for the great book, Betty's Goes Vegan. We had 13 people submit their names, and I'm going to randomly, I'm looking at scraps.
I'll do a drum roll.
I'm looking at scraps of paper now, and let's just randomly pick one. Let's see. Oh, our own Danielle Pilon.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Congratulations, Danielle. We'll have to give that to you next time we see you. All right, and I have some events to tell you guys about. I'm sure we're probably listing these ones weekly, but we just want to make sure that everyone is aware to go out and join these events. The weekly chicken vigil from Fridays from 7 to 9 a.m., and that's at Commercial Drive in Hastings Street, just outside the storage facility and slaughterhouse. It's a very kind of uplifting, energetic event to try to just spread the awareness of what's going on in that community, and also hopefully, you know, spread the message of the vegan lifestyle in a non, you know, threatening kind of way. So it's a great event, and I hope that you people can join us. And on the same day as the shark fin demos, every Friday night from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., join Vancouver Animal Defense League at 3888 Main Street, Sanswewa in Vancouver. Well, they'll be speaking out for the sharks and against the horrific shark fin industry, where 100 million sharks are killed every year for their fins. And also, Jeff Rogers and a group of raw fooders from Seattle are coming to Vancouver to do the grouse grind. All those interested are welcome to join the group, leaving the bottom of the grind at 11 a.m. on this coming Saturday, the 24th. And also on Saturday is the Gray's Summer Barbecue Dinner, and that is at 2 p.m. from 2 to 11. You'll get a heaping plate of vegan barbecue goodies with a beverage for $17, and you're supporting, sorry, I have to say it, watch the language, but fuck cancer.
it's an actual charity.
Yes, it is the charity. Sorry, I had to say that. I wasn't sure if I was supposed to warn you guys, but and the website for that organization is letsfcancer.com. It sounds like a great organization because they're just using education rather than
and
research.
Prevention. Yeah.
Prevention, which exactly. Is more effective than a lot of other charities. And also on Saturday, Vancouver Meatless Meetup presents a fundraiser with Dr. Tuttle, who we'll be interviewing shortly, and Deborah Rosso, sorry, I don't know how to pronounce her name, at Oak Ridge Seventh-day Adventist Hall, which is at 5350 Bale Street in Vancouver. And it's a free event open to all, and there will be door prizes as well. So hopefully you can make it out there. And if you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
Yeah, and did you go to the weekly chicken vigil this morning?
I didn't this week, no.
You've been going to almost...
I've been going to as many as I can make, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. Next we will have Dr. Will Tuttle for our feature interview. Dr. Will Tuttle is an educator, author, and composer. He has lectured and performed widely throughout North America and Europe, and he's the author of the number one selling Amazon best-selling book, The World Peace Diet, and recipient of the Peace Abbey's Courage of Conscience Award. He's been traveling with his spouse, Madeline, full-time for 17 years in their solar-powered rolling home, presenting over 150 lectures, retreats, workshops, and concerts per year through churches, conferences, spiritual gatherings, and for yoga, vegetarian, meditation, environmental, peace, and social justice communities. As mentioned, he'll be speaking in Vancouver tomorrow, and we are honored to have him on the show today. Hello, Dr. Tuttle, and welcome again to Animal Voices Show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you here. Thank you.
Thank you, and also, happy belated birthday.
Happy birthday. Just
all right.
That. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So last week was Vegan Palooza. Can you tell us a little bit about this annual event, like who some of the speakers were and what the intention of the event is?
Great, yes. Basically, the intention of the event is to try to bring as much attention and awareness about veganism as possible to the general public, and also help those who are already vegan to thrive as vegans and to be more effective vegan advocates. And some of the main speakers we had this time, we had actually almost 45 speakers total, including the special VIP speakers. But the main speakers during the main sessions, we had some well-known ones like James Cameron, the actor, John Sally, the basketball champion, Scott Jurek, the championship ultra-marathoner, and we had Heather Mills, a very well-known activist from England, and then we had people like Dr. Michael Greger, Dr. Michael Clapper, Dr. Alan Goldhammer, Chef AJ, John Pierre, and Robert Cheek, and Dr. Richard Openlander, Dr. Karen Davis, Gene Bauer, the founder of Farm Sanctuary, and Jenny Brown, the founder of Woodstock Animal Sanctuary. A lot of these people are authors of well-known books. Norm Phelps, a well-known animal rights and vegan philosopher, author of a number of books. So we try to give a wide range of perspectives: sanctuary operators, chefs, restaurateurs, athletes, and philosophers, environmentalists, activists. All of them are vegan. You know, that's the main thing. And showing the importance of veganism, the benevolent side effects of veganism, environmentally, health-wise, and so forth, and also helping people to not eat. Quite a bit of emphasis was on vegans not eating vegan junk food, I think.
Oh, that's great.
It was really a vegan palooza, and I just want to congratulate you just for the lineup of fantastic speakers
definitely.
For 4 days. I listened in as much as I could whenever I was at my computer, and I was just really grateful to be able to listen to these really high-quality speakers. Mm.
I did as well. It was amazing. Amazing. So thank you again for putting on that event. I look forward to next year. And people can go online if they want and purchase the podcast as well, can't they?
Yeah, actually, right. You can go to veganpalooza.com. We're having it still half price, all the recordings and transcripts and everything through tomorrow, Saturday, at the end of the day. So that's available if anyone's interested. We have some up are free. You can listen to the first two, the last two, and just, I think a few other things there too.
Cool.
Still, it was free when it happened, but now we still have it available. Yeah.
Awesome. And so for those who haven't read your book, The World Peace Diet, before, which I highly recommend every human being should read, can you give us a brief introduction about what your book is about and how you came to decide to write this amazing book?
Thank you. Basically, the main idea in The World Peace Diet is that all of us are born into a culture that has a hidden core that we're not supposed to know about, think about, talk about at all, which has to do primarily with our routine mistreatment of animals for food and seeing them merely as objects to be used, and then forcing little kids, basically from the time we're infants, to participate in the primary rituals in which this fundamental mentality is injected into all of us, which are the daily meals, forcing little kids to eat the meat and other byproducts of animals that are enslaved and killed. And so the basic idea is that this really unknown, unrecognized practice and mentality in it, we just think it's normal to do this, plants the seeds within our own consciousness, causing all of the problems that we're having, like war and violence between people of various types, the disease and environmental devastation that we're experiencing, world hunger, and psychological and social problems in general. And so I just trace the whole thing historically, anthropologically, socially, culturally, psychologically, spiritually, through spiritual teachings of the world as well as the religious teachings of the world. And so the whole idea is to give the big picture of the ramifications of our culture's mistreatment of animals for food, and the enormous benefits of moving toward a plant-based diet for ethical reasons.
It's amazing. I love your interconnectedness and how you tie everything together. I'm actually a yoga teacher, so I was super happy to finally have a book that made the connection between spirituality and veganism, which are two important parts of my life. And Vancouver's a city where many people practice yoga and other spiritual practices. Why do you think that veganism is not often mentioned or discussed in books, conferences, or retreats? I mean, it is sometimes, but not often.
Right. Well, generally speaking, it's because people are uncomfortable with this. And we like to think of ourselves as conscious, aware, kind, loving, caring people. And anything that goes against that causes cognitive dissonance, so we would rather not really look at it. It would be kind of like going into South Carolina maybe in 1840 and to a yoga conference and saying, well, you know, what about slavery? People don't, you know, slaveholders don't think they're doing anything wrong, really. They think they have all these rationalizations and justifications why black people are inferior and the best thing is to enslave them and so forth, and they think it's perfectly good. And they don't want to hear about it because that's what they've been indoctrinated into. So that's the basic reasons. It's a cultural program that is injected into all of us by our parents and teachers and all the authority figures in our lives growing up. And so we are forced, in a sense, to believe certain beliefs that we don't arrive at on our own. And so it's very essentially traumatic for us to be confronted by those because it exposes behavior that we can't really explain. And so the best way to avoid the whole thing is to just not talk about it and avoid and basically go into a disconnected state. So that's the main reason. But I will say, of course, that there's, I think, nothing more healthy anyone can do than to actually bring this into consciousness and become more aware. If you really want to heal, if you really want to practice yoga from the point of view of what yoga is designed to do, which is to deepen our sense of being integrated and whole, complete spiritual beings, then this is, I think, the most important thing we can address, actually.
Definitely. I feel like veganism is part of my yoga practice. It is what helps me understand the interconnectedness of everything. And it's such an important part for me, and that's why sometimes it's hard when you see people who practice yoga but aren't quite there, but I understand that idea of cognitive dissonance. So do you think we can be truly spiritual and compassionate while still eating animals?
I think there's a ceiling. You know, it's like having a built-in limitation. I think we can, in a sense, go higher in our awareness. I mean, we can be less violent and more aware than, say, we were earlier, and still be eating meat and dairy products and so forth. But basically, the foundation, what veganism is, I believe today, is a modern iteration, in a sense, a modern way of articulating the ancient Sanskrit word ahimsa, which means nonviolence, which is really the core spiritual teaching of all the world religions, the basic teaching that we will never be happy, we will never evolve spiritually as long as we are violent, as long as I am harming others for my own benefit. So to answer your question, no, I don't think anyone can be, as you say, truly spiritual or compassionate while still paying people to stab animals for food or still harming animals unnecessarily for food. We know clearly now that basically anyone can do fine on a plant-based diet, and we are born into a society where we're forced essentially to forego that and to not understand this, but there's millions of people doing great on plant-based diets and living in a vegan way and thriving. And so in order to kill animals for food, we're essentially doing something that's not necessary typically because we're following orders. I think that's the main reason. I don't think people are inherently cruel and violent and want to just and mean-spirited and just want to harm animals. I think it's just we're programmed to do it by our parents, and we're following orders, and we don't want to question those orders because they come from very high up, in a sense, in our society.
Definitely. And I mean, I'm also actually a nutritionist, so I know that we can strive on a vegan diet. I often hear people say that they could not be vegan, or they've tried being vegan, but it made them sick or weak, and now they're happy eating happy organic meat. One of my favorite parts in your book is about the placebo effect. Can you explain this, and also what your thoughts are on this happy meat craze, I feel like, is going on?
Yeah, right. No, I think that's a naturally a very, you know, predictable result as people become more aware through undercover investigations and just the general conversations in our society about the enormous cruelty inherent in factory farming, you know, in the way we do. But you've got to remember that factory farming is a natural, as Karen Davis pointed out in Vegan Palooza, is a natural extension of farming. It's just basically maximizing profit. But that all farming of animals, all animal agriculture, is inherently violent and cruel. You cannot do animal agriculture without enormous violence. Just looking at another being and saying, you are my property, and I control your movements, and I control who, how you're impregnated, and your babies are not your babies, those are my babies, and I decide when you die, and I decide what you'll eat, and I decide what you'll be vaccinated with, and all these things are enormously cruel and violent. And if we did to dogs and cats, mm-hmm. what we do to pigs and cows, and the people who are praised as being these wonderful, happy meat farmers, if they did that to cows and, what they do to cows, to dogs and cats, they'd be thrown in jail, and they would be reviled as the most horrible, cruel people mm-hmm. in our society. So we have to realize there's this huge double standard, and there is no way to kill an animal in a humane way. I mean, killing is the worst thing that we can do, or commit terrible pain, both of which happen actually in so-called happy meat scenarios. Mm-hmm. And we don't have enough time to go into that, but basically there's
come back again.
slaughterhouses that are used do the same or very often even worse things mm-hmm. than the high-speed slaughterhouses. There's more time actually for sadism and cruelty on the parts of the workers, for example. So so-called happy meat can have horrific cruelty involved. So there's that. And then the placebo effect basically is something that's well recognized, actually, in medicine and in our
definitely.
Society in general. It's simply it's kind of the mind-body effect, but it makes our whole scientific establishment very nervous because we're born in a meat-eating society that is essentially materialistic philosophically and wants to think that that matter is everything and our minds don't affect our bodies. But we all know that our minds and our thoughts and our feelings very strongly affect our physiology and our hormones and our bodies. So I think that's an important thing to remember, that as we move to a plant-based diet, we may, number one, start cleansing, and as we mm-hmm. cleanse, we may feel like we're getting sick, but it's actually a beneficial process of cleansing out all toxins. We may feel worse or weak, but it's our body cleansing. That's number one. Number two, the placebo effect may kick in, and we have these deep memories of being told by our parents and teachers and government authorities and so forth that we won't be healthy if we don't eat dairy products or if we don't get enough protein from animal foods. And those deep beliefs will kick in at a subconscious level, and sure enough, we don't feel that good, and we'll eat, and the placebos, the more disgusting they are or the more expensive they are, the better they work. And meat, once someone gives it up, starts to become disgusting. And so we find it's very, very interesting how someone will eat some meat and say, oh, I feel so much better. And I think a lot of it definitely can be attributed to the placebo effect and ingesting something that's very repulsive, which it naturally is. To eat the flesh of an animal is naturally repulsive to us, all of us. But we force ourselves to do it, and then we find it makes a very powerful placebo. And so I think it's important for people when they go vegan to do some inner work and realize, and some outer work, and just mm-hmm. do the research and realize that all the nutrients we need we can get from plant-based sources. We don't need to get them from animals, and we can thrive as vegans.
Definitely.
As human beings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh,
I would also just like to add, as research and going vegan, you must read The World Peace yes. Diet. There's my plug.
Definitely.
Great.
So, Dr. Tella, we have about 5 minutes left. So I want to ask you a big question, so take your time to answer it. But so I think you've kind of touched on this a bit, but what can you each of us do today, every day, to effectively contribute to world peace? And what did you mean by, or what do you mean by the benevolent revolution? I love that word, by the way.
Oh, right. Yeah, those two go together. I think basically the idea is that we live in a society where the sacred feminine within all of us, which I refer to in the World Peace Diet as Sophia,
yes, it's a great section of the book.
This is something I think it's very important to understand, that in animal agriculture, it's the female animals that are by far the worst treated, and it's specifically their reproductive organs and reproductive cycles and nesting and nurturing their babies. That's what we dominate with an iron fist, and we live in a society where we're taught as both men and women, to view the feminine as merely a thing to be used and to repress, dominate, and exploit that. And so that suppresses our inner natural sense of kindness and compassion, caring, and protectiveness of the earth and of children and of each other and of our planet and of animals. And so I think the most important thing anyone can do today to effectively contribute to world peace is to make the efforts, first of all, to understand what's going on in animal agriculture, second of all, to bring back Sophia within yourself, to reconnect with the sacred feminine dimension of kindness and compassion and caring within ourselves, in an authentic way by actually caring about those who are at our mercy and who, to whom we're not showing any mercy, animals and those, perhaps human slaves, you know, products that we're supporting and paying for. And I think, and this leads into what your, the last part of your question, which is the benevolent revolution, which I think essentially is what veganism is. I think we had this revolution about 10,000 years ago, which I refer to in the World Peace Diet as the herding revolution, where we started to own animals as property for food, and we can see where that got us. It brought us war and slavery, the domination of the feminine, this tremendous elitism, a wealthy elite controlling all of the basically the resources and the industries and corporations and so forth. And this all came out naturally of the herd of herding animals and seeing them as property merely for food. And so the vegan revolution is an evolution, I think, really. It's a growth and a movement toward the opposite of that, which is radical inclusion, radical compassion, kindness, and caring for others. And that as we do that, we'll begin to create the foundations for world peace and for sustainability and for freedom. So that's basically it. That's what I would say is the greatest thing we can do to help ourselves and each other, and especially to help the animals.
That's awesome. And by the domination of the feminine, I think people often forget that we're talking also about eggs and dairy and not just the animals are bred and killed. And I think oftentimes people forget about that, or they don't realize how much suffering. Because even myself personally, I was a vegetarian for about 18 years before I became vegan. I, you know, didn't make the connections.
Same with me.
Yeah.
Didn't know.
Yeah. And so I think now I'm like happy that there's a movement, because I might have heard it, but I think I kind of always turned a blind eye, that kind of cognitive dissonance. But now as vegans, we're out there explaining that it's not just the meat, it's the dairy and the eggs.
I feel that veganism is a message now, not vegetarianism. We've moved beyond that. Do you feel that's the same, Dr. Tuttle, in just all the stuff out there in the media and people educating, that it's go vegan, not go lacto-ovo-vegetarian?
Well, there's two main reasons for that. One is that veganism is a word that was coined by Donald Watson in 1945 that explicitly includes within its definition the concept of motivation, and the motivation is compassion. The motivation is not health or saving money or anything else personal. The motivation is to minimize our cruelty to animals by not harming them for anything, for food, clothing, or any purpose at all. Mm-hmm. So it's much more broad-based and includes motivation. And dairy and eggs, basically, we understand now, contain just as much suffering, perhaps more suffering, than the flesh of animals in terms of actual cruelty to dairy cows and to hens for eggs. So, yes, it's very important, I think, to understand this and to see oneself more as vegan. But usually people move first to vegetarian and then to vegan. So it's important, I guess, also to realize that very often the actual change does happen in a step-by-step basis.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was also step-by-step, but it's good that it's out there now. And thank you so much for being on our show, for writing the book. I'm just a super fan. So I'm very honored to have you on.
Yeah, thank you so much. I hope everyone can see, can come to the lecture on Saturday night. And we also have a website, worldpeacediet.org, and there's more information there about our trainings, the facilitator training and mastery program and so forth.
Yeah,
so thank you so much for the work you're doing.
Thank you so much. I wanted to talk to you about the World Peace Diet Facilitator Program, but maybe next time you're on our show, we'll have to discuss that.
Sounds great.
Perfect, Dr. Tuttle. Thank you so much for being on our show and returning again to Animal Voices. I strongly encourage, thank you so much. I strongly encourage everyone to get a copy of the World Peace Diet. It is for everybody, for vegans, for non-vegans, for carnivores, for omnivores. I cannot say it enough. It is one of the most beautifully written, well-researched book. All the research is in the back, so you can find references to everything. Like Dr. Tuttle mentioned, you can visit his website at worldpeacediet.com or worldpeacediet.org for more information on his book, his music, his lectures, and much more. And of course, he's in Vancouver tomorrow, as we discussed earlier.
Yeah, and there will be copies of his books and his CDs. He's a composer, too. Mm-hmm. That kind of brings us to the end of the show here, because we're going to play one of his songs. He's just a wonderful all-around person. He creates beautiful piano music, and we'll be playing some of that soon. You have been listening to the Animal Voices radio show on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Next week's show is a surprise, so please tune in for that next Friday, August the 30th. We here at the Animal Voices show modestly ask you to please keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. tribe, you can do so by signing up for our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. Please do join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Also, please do check out our website, animalvoices.org, where our shows can also be downloaded from. And if you appreciate the work that we do here every week at Animal Voices to bring you original quality programming on the topics of current animal issues and the vegan lifestyle, please do show us your support by making a donation to us at Animal Voices at Co-op Radio, because we do rely on your donations to keep the show on the air. To make a donation of $5, $10, $20, or whatever you can afford, please go to cooperadio.org and click on Donate to Co-op Radio. And remember to indicate on your donation that it's going towards Animal Voices. That keeps us on the air. If you're in Canada, your donations are tax deductible for any amount donated through the Co-op Radio website, and for and every little bit helps. So we do thank you for your assistance. I'm really excited about the event tomorrow. You're going to be there.
I'm going to be there.
Yeah, excellent. I'm actually going to be Dr. Tuttle's personal assistant, so I will be busy helping him. And as I said, he's going to be playing the piano there too. So all this information, there's a link on our website, animalvoices.org. You can also go to meetup.com/meatlessmeetup and find all the info there. It's free. There's going to be lots of food for purchase and vegan food potluck, and also a raw food speaker there. It's basically starting at 3 p.m. and going until 7 and beyond. So we're closing the show now with a piece by Dr. Will Tuttle entitled Fish Song for the Turtles, as it has an aquatic theme to it. Stay tuned now for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.